small. There's a calm I can't explain. The rock hand is melted, only diamonds now remain. Good morning from North Carolina. This is NC Fro is Reading. I'm your host, Felicia Baxter. I'm having all kind of crazy stuff happening this morning. I found out the recorder that I'm actually using, it won't let you pause for a long period of time before it basically times out. So you're basically forced to basically restart all over again or post two separate recordings, because I haven't figured out how to use the Audacity sound mixer on my computer yet. But it's coming. I'm getting there. I think this time is actually really, really funny or fun for me, because I'm discovering a lot that I really don't like disruptions. This is my truth for today. My truth is, of course, you're not going to talk me to death. But my other truth is actually a more simple truth, is that I don't like disruption. Most people or most humans do like to get really used to the sameness, but you should never mix up or confuse being in a rut to routine. Routine is different. Routine is something, if it's positive, if it allows you to get things done with excellence, that's actually okay. That's actually a very good routine. But if you're just in a rut out of convenience and out of laziness, you're going to pay for that in the end, because you're never going to excel. You probably won't be very happy, and you'll confuse being very fatigued for depression, you won't be confused, because you will be depressed. You'll just think you're always tired and you need to get more sleep. No, that's actually very depressed, or a depressed spirit. We should actually rage against that every day. And we need to also do things that help us not be that way, or that help us keep moving forward with positivity. And doing things like this actually make me really happy. It gives a little spice to the day. I just have to be careful, because I'm with we've transitioned to a new employer, a big conglomerate. And if I had any success with this, they could actually claim some of it. And that actually ticks me off probably more than anything. I'll get on with today's program. We meaning Marianne and I, basically finished up with the 12 Tribes of Hattie. unlike Bobby Brown's book, which I actually still like, and I'm actually going to go back to after this posting. But I think this book is actually a work of literature, or a very good work in general, a work of art. We talked about multiple themes of psychopathology that is rampant throughout the book. We also discussed just the great loss and what racism and hatred will actually do for you. We ended with the last chapter, and that's where I take my reading from today. It is called Sallah, 1980. And just a little background on the book itself. The book takes place throughout a 20, 30-year period of the lives of a woman that was born in the South and through the Great Exodus came up north. And she watched her twin babies die in her arms. And at that time, there was a medicine, miracle medicine, called penicillin that basically could have saved them. But she was given only home remedies and charged for it by the jackleg physician that came to see her in her home. And then she was actually in a great depression throughout that time. In order to protect herself, she withheld the love and attention from her children. They could have been, there were little pods of greatness because they could have been artists and pianists. And her one son, Floyd, basically could have been, he was a great musician, but he was struggling with his own demons. If they had had a nurturing environment, they would have been even greater or more than the survivors that they were. She said she did it to prepare them for a world that would not love them, that would not care for them, to make them hard. But at the same time, they needed to have a baseline to prepare them for that type of poor treatment. So the one glimmer of hope is her granddaughter that was born by Cassie, or Cassie is one of the 12 children of Hattie. Cassie ends up having, it looks like a psychotic break. She ends up getting locked in, or they have to take her and have her basically locked in a mental institution. But she leaves behind her Sallah, who is the granddaughter. Sallah woke at sunset, cold seeped through the window next to her bed. And you, every now and then you're going to hear me take a sip of coffee and also French style yogurt because it's good and it's morning. Sallah woke at sunset, cold seeped through the window next to her bed. The sheets were too tight. Sallah's grandmother had tucked them around her, pulled them so tight the girl's arms were pinned and she had to strain to straighten her feet. She didn't know how long she'd been sleeping. Outside the trees and houses, wires and telephone poles were black silhouettes against the red-orange sunset. A few drooping leaves hung like sleeping bats from an oak spire, black branches. Sallah's mother had been taken away the week before. Gone were Cassie's suitcase and bobby pins, her wide tooth comb and maroon sweater, the tube of almond-colored concealer she dotted under her eyes. In the backyard, the light snapped off in Sallah's grandfather's tool shed. He walked into the lawn and paused. His body turned towards Sallah's window. August! Hattie called from the kitchen. August, supper! August's face was hiding in the shadow. He leaned forward as though trying to see into Sallah's room. He was not so steady on his feet these days. Sallah was afraid he would fall. The back door squeaked open and the long rectangle of light fell across the grass. Hattie came out into the yard wearing her apron. August walked toward her with his hand outstretched. She took it and helped him climb the back steps. The door closed behind them and the yard fell to darkness. The wood behind the house was black and still. Good night, trees, Sallah thought. She waited for her grandmother to come and turn on the bedroom light. She pulled at the sheet, squirming in her swaddling. She was afraid she might vomit. Sallah had been sent home early from school that day. At mid-morning, she felt a sudden vertigo. her stomach churned and the classroom brightened into a cube of light so white and disorienting. Though she willed it, her body would not stay in the chair. She slid to the floor. A huge fuss followed. There was talk of an ambulance. Sally was carried to a cot in a nurse's office where adults talked about her as though she were not there. I think there's something going on at home. She's been distracted in class, they said. The school nurse loomed over her. We're calling your mother to come get you. 20 minutes later, August arrived. A pot lit bang. Hattie was in the kitchen cooking and displeased. Sally struggled out of the sheets and sat up in bed, determined to appear well when her grandmother came to check on her. She would come in and see that Sally had recovered. She would realize people could will themselves heal, and she'd bring Sally's mother back. Sally's eyes were gritty, as though there was dust under them, under the lids. She picked up the pillow and hugged it to her chest. It smelled of her mother's hairdressing oil. She drifted off and jerked awake again. Sometime later, two hands shifted her downward and tugged the covers up to her chin. A calloused palm passed over her cheek. She asleep, August whispered to Hattie. He walked out of the room, whistling a tune softly. 2 days before they took her away, Cassie dug up the front yard in the middle of the afternoon. Sally came home from school to find the lawn pocked with holes and scattered with clumps of brown grass and mounds of gray, scraggly roots. There was dirt strewn on the slate pathway that led to the front door, dirt piled on top of the gravel in the driveway, dirt in Cassie's hair, Hattie's winter's flowers, thickly purple things that looked like open heads of cabbages, were hacked apart and wobbling roots up in the center of the ruined flower beds. Cassie kneeled next to the maple tree. She held the shovel by the blade with both hands and jabbed it into the ground. Mom? Sally called. Mom? Cassie raised her arms above her head and drove the shovel into the earth. Her leather gloves were ripped where the shade's blade cut into them. The neighbors on either side of the house watched from their porches. Sally's grandmother stood in the doorway with both hands pressed against the screen, palms flat as though she could push the scene away. Sally, Cassie said, breathless, help me pull up this root. Sally didn't move. Come on, help me. What are you doing? Sally asked. Cassie set the shovel aside and used her hands to dig into the hole she made. Can't we go inside? Let's go inside. She bent over and tugged at the back of her mother's jacket with both hands. She began to cry. Mom, please, let's go inside. Inside? Cassie said, now. She glanced at Hattie standing in the doorway. She leaned into Sally and whispered, we have to be careful with Grandmom and Grandpop. They're putting something in our food. But, she said, explaining a couple of weeds, these are plants out here that I can use to cure us. There's people watching. Sally said, don't mind them. They're all in on it. Cassie looked at a neighbor woman standing on her porch. I know what you're up to, she shouted. Hattie ran outside. Cassie, come on in now. That's enough. Cassie sifted through the dirt with her hands. At least let me take Sally inside. You don't want her out here like this. Sally tucked again at her mother's coat, but Cassie had gone back to her shoveling and swatted her hand away as though it were a fly. Hattie led Sally inside, and the two of them stood side by side in the doorway, watching Cassie move across the yard, scooping clumps of dirt into bags. They shivered in the chill afternoon air coming in through the screen door. Sally wondered if she ought to stand so close to her grandmother, if Hattie wasn't transmitting something poisonous through her clothes. She wondered if there really was any poison. Then she worried she betrayed her mother with her doubt. Cassie didn't have anyone but Sally, but Grandmom and Grandpop had each other and Sally's aunts and uncles. Sala tallied these bonds, measured the scales of defenselessness and need. She always concluded that her mother needed her more than anyone else. She sidestepped away from her grandmother. She decided she could stand next to her as long as there were a few inches between them. In this way, she could satisfy everyone involved. In this way, she would not lose anyone's love. Cassie came inside at sunset. She hurried Sala into the bedroom they shared and locked the door behind them. She set a pack of razor blades and a pair of yellow rubber gloves on the bedside table. Cassie emptied the bags of pool roots onto the newspaper, sliced them with the blades. Sala watched from the bed. "Don't cry," Cassie said. "Remember that song about the Lord's army? That's us, the Lord's soldier. He's taking care of us." Sala did not feel taken care of. Cassie had not changed her clothes, her pants, her grass stained and muddy. Dirt streaked her face. Her fingernails were black. She hardly glanced at Sala as she sliced the roots. She cut her finger and the blood dripped onto the newspaper. Under her breath, Cassie sang, "I'm in the Lord's army." "Sing it with me, Sala. I may never march in the infantry, ride in the cavalry, shoot the artillery. Come on, Sala, sing it with me. I'm in the Lord's army, yes, sir." There wasn't anything to do but sing along when she was like this. Cassie, never tired, she could go on singing and slicing all night. There were times Sala would wake with the first light and find her mother sprawled across the bed or lying on the floor, or sometimes, and this was much worse, awake and praying in an armchair near the window. Now Sala sings so that her mother would be comforted and Sala would not feel so separate from her and so alone. By round three, Sala and Cassie were shouting. Maybe Sala thought there was medicine in the roots her mother had pulled from the yard. "Mom knows lots of things. I'm only 10. What do I know about anything?" "Don't mind all that noise," Cassie said. Sala's grandparents were knocking on the bedroom door. They wanted to stop them singing, to come out and talk. "Let Sala have her supper at least," August said. Cassie ignored them. Sally didn't dare say she wanted to eat dinner with her grandparents. As the night wore on, the telephone in the kitchen rang with increased frequency. Long after the hour at which the house was usually silent, Sala heard her grandparents' voices and a sheriff's footsteps against the carpet. Cassie covered the bedroom floor with grocery store sales circulars piled with chopped roots. Sala sat in the middle of the bed with a quilt pulled around her shoulders. "Have you ever been in a boat?" she asked her mother. "This bed is a boat and the papers are the ocean, see?" Sala said, bouncing on the bed to simulate the motion of the waves. She drew her knees to her chest. "Mom," she said, "Mom, I don't feel well." What she meant was, "What is happening?" What she meant was, "Please stop this." "Mom," she called again, "sing some more," Cassie said without turning from the root she was cutting up. When Hattie's children were young, they called her the General. They thought she didn't know, but she knew everything about each one of them. She could feel their vibrating souls. When he was a boy, Franklin joked that Hattie had superpowers because she always knew which children were upstairs, which were out on the porch, which had gone down the block to the corner store. She'd be in the kitchen and get an odd sensation on the back of her neck, like someone was tapping her there. She looked up from whatever she was doing and called out to one of the girls, "Go tell your brother I said stop fooling around up there in the attic." Sure enough, that's where he'd be, about to fall through the trap door onto the second floor landing. Sala had fallen asleep again. "I'm sorry," Hattie thought, looking at her granddaughter. She'd seen Sala running after the car the afternoon they took Cassie to the hospital, but she hadn't said anything to August. He would have wanted to stop and explain things. And what could they have said? Hattie had looked through the rearview mirror at Sala waving and running. She glanced at Cassie, who was so taken up with whatever was in her head, she couldn't see anything outside of herself. Every bit of Cassie was twitching, eyes twitching and hands twitching and mind and the very soul of her twitching. How Hattie had wanted to sit in the back seat with her and hold her hand until she stopped shaking. When Hattie was a girl in Georgia, they'd have taken Cassie to the preacher, and if that hadn't healed her, they would have kept her fed and clothed and left her alone to be how she was. Hattie snorted. She couldn't go to the hospital bloody and dying, much less when someone went wrong in the head. It was true that a part of Hattie blamed Cassie's condition on a failure of character, a creeping weakness that had gotten the better of her. But when she saw Sala running toward the car, she knew Cassie wouldn't have wanted her child to see her in her worst hour. That was Hattie's kindness. She had spared her daughter and grandchild that pain. August was 74, sick and getting sicker. It was just so typical of him to run into the arms of God when his heart was too weak for him to run into the arms of some woman. He persuaded Hattie to go with him to the local church, and she discovered to her surprise that it was a place of solace and beauty. The church brought her great peace, and if she only pretended to believe, if she was a fraud, well, that was the price she had to pay for comfort and fellowship. They arrived at the pew. August was waiting. I'm going to go back a little bit. Sala was seeking salvation. When they asked or opened the doors of the church, Sala stood and ran to the altar. And this is the part that I was very much interested in. The congregation began to hum. They did this every Sunday during the altar call. Sala was always amazed that they knew exactly when to begin and which tune to hum. Now they hummed for her. She felt a tingling at the top of her head. She felt her body relax into the preacher's arms. "Do you accept Jesus as your Savior?" Brother Merrill asked again. "I do," said Sala. She closed her eyes and waited for the Spirit. It would surround her, gather her in its embrace. She felt a hand on her shoulder, hot and urgent and tightening. She opened her eyes. Her grandmother stood next to her. "No," Hattie said. "Sister Shepherd," said the preacher. "What's the matter, sister?" "No," Hattie said again and pulled Sala away from him. The organ thrum stopped, the congregation hummed as well. The sanctuary was silent. Hattie pulled her granddaughter down the center aisle. She couldn't allow it. She had lost six to the altar. She sent him off to Alabama with nothing but a Bible, and he had become a womanizer and an impostor. By the time she understood the depth of his unhappiness, it had been too late to save him. Her twins were dead. She had given Ella back to Georgia. It was too late for Cassie, whom Hattie had also sent away. And it was too late for Hattie, who was a fraud in Christ, and who had shown Sala the ways of fraudulence. She couldn't bear that the child was already so broken she was driven to the mercy seat. There was time for Sala. Hattie didn't know how to save her granddaughter. She felt as overwhelmed and unprepared as she had when she was a young mother at 17. "Here we are, 60 years out of Georgia," she thought. "A new generation has been born, and there's still the same wounding and the same pain. I can't allow it," she shook her head. "I can't allow it." They arrived at the pew where August was waiting. "I don't know why you've done that, Hattie," he whispered. Of course he didn't. August's faith was simple and absolute. He had aged into a sickly old man who prayed and loved the Lord. And if he understood more than he let on, he was wiser than he acted. He kept it to himself. It's easier to play the fool, Hattie thought. And Hattie and August always did what was easy. She felt a spark of her old anger, but they were past all of that. It hadn't served her when she was young, and it wouldn't serve her now. Hattie looked around at the disapproving faces of the congregation. Their indignation would pass. Everything passed sooner or later. And if it didn't, she would give up the church to this dear comfort of her old age. She was not too old to weather another sacrifice. Hattie put her arm around Sala and pulled her close. She patted her granddaughter's back roughly, unaccustomed as she was to tenderness. One of the things that I found interesting or telling is just the frustration and how things could flip or go bad very fast. Religion can be used as a comfort, as Hattie detailed in her own mind. And it could be used in positive ways if you are given enough backup, if you have enough discernment. Sometimes religion can be used in negative ways to cut people off, and they can use the Bible to justify their poor actions. For almost 200, 300 years, slavery was justified using the verses of the Old Testament. But in Hattie's warped mind, she finally realized that it was too late for the adults, but she recognized her own insanity, that she couldn't continue to use her anger, which I do believe was frustration, to deal with the world. And she, in order for you to be strong, you have to be put, you have to put in the positive psychological work. You learn how to be strong, how to love, how to be positive from your parents and your grandparents. She finally realized what her mistake was. She knew she had to do something different, even though she didn't know how. But I think deep down, she could finally give or pass on the strength of character onto her granddaughter that she was unable to do with her own children. It seems like all of them had some type of bipolar disorder. Belle, Cassie, Alice, all of them had some type of, and it all stemmed back to the mother. How Freudian, I know, but at the same time, you learn how to feel and how, and compassion and how to love definitely from your mother and the balance of that love from your father. And again, she realized her mistake and she vowed, even though she didn't know how, that she was going to correct that in with dealing with her granddaughter. And if anyone could do it, I think Hattie can do it. She survived up until that point. And I think when she sets her mind at something, from getting the house to finally having to give up her daughter, you know, to making the right decisions, she could actually do it. And that's what actually made me so positive that she would be able to pull off this great feat of character. That's where I would like to end it today. I want to thank my one listener to listen up to how my perception of this book. And I also wanted to read a little bit something that I think summarized what my thought process a little bit better. I have found that I have some of the same thoughts as other writers. However, they actually have the clarity of the thought to actually produce my thoughts actually a lot better than I could actually produce them. And being able to research and get to those, their thoughts, is actually a challenge. And I also find very entertaining, and it keeps me grounded. I actually went to a website. It's called Super Summary, where it summarized Ayanna Mathis's 12 Tribes of Hattie, and it ended with basically an explanation or summary of this last chapter. Later in 1980, Hattie and August bring their oldest living daughter, Cassie, to a mental institution. She had been hearing voices and has become a danger to herself and her daughter, Sala. Hattie feels overwhelmed at the thought of raising one last child, but takes Sala in nonetheless. It is mentioned that Six has become a reverend, but not a holy one. He has developed a reputation as a womanizer. At church, Sala goes up to the altar to be saved, seeking spiritual mercy, but Hattie prevents her. In doing so, Hattie finds the tenderness her own children have never experienced since the twins' death. Her purpose is to prevent Sala from feeling she is somehow wounded or broken. Hattie hopes that with Sala, she will be able to fix the mistake she has made with her own children. The 12 Tribes of Hattie was a critical success, with book lists praising Mathis's stunning authority, clarity, and courage. It made NPR's list of best books of the year. In 2012, the book was selected as Oprah's Book Club pick. Mathis works as an assistant professor of English and creative writing at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And it has been truly an honor to include this book in Book Club 2018. And it has been my further honor to be able to read from you a section of the book and give you a little bit of background on just how great this book was. I hope to further this discussion later as I have the time to go back and reread it and come up with some other truths. But at this time, I'm going to let you go because I actually have to go to work now. This is an NC Fro is Reading recording. Everybody have a great day.